My scripture is Hebrews 11, verses 1 through 3. Hebrews 11, verses 1 through 3. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible.
Good morning. Glad that you're able to be with us today. We're starting a sermon. I don't want to call it a series because that seems to imply some length. Think of it as a part one, part two sermon. So it's just a really long sermon that I broke into two pieces instead of a series. So I don't know what you call that, but that's what we're doing. We're going to be in Hebrews chapter 11 this week and then, Lord willing, next week as well, talking about faith and how it relates to this thing that the Hebrews text calls a cloud of witnesses. And then this is kind of a lead-in, I hope, to the fall quarter of classes. You may have caught in the announcements or in the bulletin, this coming quarter, in the Sunday morning rotation of classes, the auditorium class for the adults, the young and families class, the teenage class, the fourth to sixth grade class, are all going to be going through the book of Hebrews this fall. And in fact, this Saturday, we're even doing a training workshop for any of the adult teachers who, in any of the classes, who'd like to come on Saturday morning from 8 to, I'm saying 8 to noon. It won't be longer than noon. I'm hoping it's actually shorter than that. And we're going to go through the material, the workbook material of the book of Hebrews, and kind of discuss what's involved so we're all on the same page. Anyway, all of that said, Hebrews is the topic of discussion going to be coming up. We'll be focusing our attention on Sunday mornings in the classes starting in September. So this is maybe a way to kind of tease your interest in that book. Why would I have to tease your interest in it? Well, because Hebrews is sort of an acquired taste, something like horseradish or wasabi or something. It's not something that everybody likes. Some people are crazy about it. Some people are not. Some people find it just a twisted riddle within a riddle within a riddle within a riddle. He talks about some fellow named Melchizedek and spends quite a long time and seems to think you should know all about him too. There's quite a lot in there that is technical in nature in the way it's presented, and yet some of it's also very straightforward, and the point seems to be overwhelmingly clear. So some people just love the book of Hebrews and wish we could spend our whole year there. Some people do not so much at all. So what I thought is we'll take two sermons, and we'll look at Hebrews chapter 11, which is towards the end of the book, but kind of gives us a taste of the book. Also, that's being the end of the book. Your teachers won't get there till like December or something, so we have plenty of time for them to work the way there. When you finally get there, it'll be all new material to you. You'll say, I can't remember what Ben said about it. It'll be great. So Hebrews chapter 11 is where we're going to be this morning. But before we get to Hebrews chapter 11, I want to give you at least a little taste of the problem of the book. In every New Testament book, especially the epistles, and we'll even include Hebrews in that, though it's not, if it's an epistle, it's not a normal epistle. In all of the New Testament literature, what you need to start with by asking is, what is the problem that this text seems to be addressing? All of the literature of the New Testament was written to be read in a church somewhere. And while it was written to be read in churches across the world, and they knew it would be circulated and spread, it also usually addressed some issue that real people in a certain place were facing. So some of them are easy. If you're reading 1 Corinthians, what's the problem in 1 Corinthians? What's the problem in Corinth? Everything. Everything is the problem in Corinth. If you can name it, that church was having a problem with it. And so just chapter after chapter of here's what you're doing wrong, quit it. Here's what you're doing wrong, quit it. There's a problem in the text, and he answers it. In Hebrews, it's not as obvious. What's the problem? And what it seems to be is that you have a group of Christians, a church somewhere, that have become disillusioned with their early commitment to Christ. Traditionally, we've said that this has been a group of Hebrew Christians, and maybe it's a pull back to Judaism that is the main problem, and that's certainly a likely alternative. There are some others, but whatever it is, it's something like that, where you have a group of people who had early on made a commitment to Christianity, to the gospel, to the church, and something has changed. Something has happened, and they're beginning to be disillusioned with what's happening. What's interesting about that is when you say it like that and take the Judaism out of it just for a moment, that sounds just like the church that we have in the world today. Our culture in America is commonly called a post-Christian culture. That is, it's a culture, a whole culture, that is increasingly disillusioned with Christianity. And maybe somewhere back there, you know, people all were okay with Christianity in some form or fashion, but now has kind of slowly decided, we're not so sure we're crazy about that after all. And in churches you see that, where you see my whole life, this is maybe a generational thing, but my whole life I grew up in churches that used to be, right? Every church I attended, just because of my age, there were people there that would say, well, you don't remember when, but used to. And they would tell me the church that used to be. Oh, the church here at Seminole used to be. And they would tell me about the things they did in that community and how big it was and how strong and vibrant it was. And the church here at this place used to have, and when my dad teached at Wetumpka, when he was the preacher at Wetumpka, the church here in Wetumpka used to have 100 and something members in it, and we did all these things. It's the church that used to be. It was down to 30 or 40 when he was there. The church here at wherever I was, it seemed like they all had a used to be story. And churches, that's a common experience for us. Churches seem to have a lifespan, and a lot of them are hitting the end of it all at the same time. And so we have a lot of that experience of people, what's happening? Is it disillusionment? I don't think people are going back to Judaism. I don't think that's the problem. But there is something going on, and people who once had a confidence in Christ are saying, well, maybe used to, but now less so. Maybe not at all. And that motion, that transition, is something that the book of Hebrews really does address. And the way it addresses it is maybe best expressed in chapter 2, just one verse before we get to chapter 11, which will be our text. In chapter 2, especially in verse 8, this is the end of this great proclamation of who Jesus is. Who is Jesus? It goes on to say, you have made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside of his control. Stop there. What's the claim of Christianity about Jesus? Christ is ruler of the universe. Jesus is Lord is the most basic confession of the church. Jesus is Lord and he rules all. What's the problem? Problem is we're not blind. And we sing that on Sunday morning, but Monday morning doesn't look that way. We look at the world around us. Does it look like Jesus is in charge of everything? Let me say it a different way. Does it look like Jesus is in charge of anything? We look at the chaos in our world and we say, well, it doesn't look like it. And that's what he says at the end of this verse. Read it again. This is kind of the middle of the verse. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside of his control. But at present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to him. This was the problem of the church. They have an enormous confession. Jesus is Lord, and everything is subject to him. The earth has been made his footstool. He has conquered death. He has conquered principalities and powers. He is the Lord of hosts. Amen. But then we look at the world, especially if you're a Christian in the first century, and it seems like there's plenty of people that have plenty of power, and it's not subject to Christ at all. It seems like they can arrest you for being a Christian. It seems like they can persecute you for being a Christian. It seems like Christians are suffering. And though Christ is said to have conquered death, it seems like Christians are still dying. So which one is it? Which one is it? You see how disillusioned you could get? That something wonderful has happened in the world and has changed the world forever. That's the confession of Christianity. But people's everyday experience was actually different than that. The first week you say, well, let's go back and let's read that again and make sure we got it right. And you sing your songs and you read your scriptures and you say your prayers. And you're fired up and ready to go and you go back to the world. And there it is again. Okay, that's okay. Sunday morning, we'll go back. Maybe we didn't get it quite right. We go back and we ask the preacher. Well, things aren't going so well. And they'd go back and they'd talk to their preacher and they would listen to the scriptures and they'd say their prayers and they'd take their communion and they'd sing their songs. And they'd be ready to go face Monday and they'd go to Monday and there it was again. Monday was not subject to Christ. How many weeks of that happened? And people started saying, maybe this is just wrong. Maybe Christ isn't in charge of anything. Maybe he's not who he claimed to be. Maybe we're not who we think we are. Maybe we had it better before. And you start to get this drift away from the confession of Christ because we don't see at present what we say to be true. We say it every Sunday, but Monday never looks that way. How can Christians live as though Christ is in charge of the world when the world doesn't look like it belongs to Christ? That may be the nutshell question of the book of Hebrews. How can that be possible? How can we do that? Did we have it right before? So the book, chapter 11 is one of many responses to that question throughout the book of Hebrews. So the book of Hebrews as a whole is just, I believe the book of Hebrews is a sermon. One of the reasons I love the book of Hebrews is because I feel at home there. Someone's preaching, right? It's not an epistle. It doesn't start out saying, to the church that is in from so-and-so, joy and peace and grace to you from our God, our Father, Jesus Christ. And now we give blessings. It doesn't even start that way, right? This isn't an epistle. If it is an epistle, it's not a normal epistle. This is a sermon. This is a person doing some preaching. There's a problem, and he's got answers, plural. He's got lots of things to say about what this problem is. And in chapter 11, he's going to get to one of those, and it's just fairly fantastic. Oop, go back. We're not there yet. It's just fairly fantastic because his principal answer, actually throughout the book, but really crowned as a jewel here in chapter 11, is faithfulness. Faithfulness is the answer. He doesn't have a trick to fix it. He can't say, oh, you're just not looking at it right. Actually, Rome is subject to Jesus. The Romans are really good people. You're misunderstanding persecutions. Caesar's a Christian, right? He can't say that because it's not true. And I can't say that to you. All you just misunderstand. Our government is actually very pro-Christian. In fact, they love Christianity and want us to flourish in Christian faith in our country and are doing everything they can to make sure they're on our side. I'd love to be able to tell you that, and we could all go home and say, oh, well, good, I just misunderstood, and that would be great. And it wouldn't be true. I'd love to tell you the next election's going to fix that. I don't think it is. I don't think the one after that's going to fix it, or the one after that. Okay, I can't tell you that because I don't think it's true. And that's what the writer here is faced with. I can't give you false hope and say, oh, no, the world's a much better place. Christians aren't really dying out there. Because they were. And by the way, they still are. Just not around here. So instead, he doesn't try to change the question and say, oh, no, you just got the facts wrong. He says, you have the facts exactly right. We do say Christ is Lord over all, and no, we do not see Christ Lord over all. Not right now. We do say both things. What connects those two dots is a doctrine called faith or faithfulness. It's a trust that what God says is coming to pass is coming to pass. And a willingness to wait to see more of it. And so he begins to express that in chapter 11, verse 1 and 2, which is most preachers' favorite passage or one of them. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the people of old received their commendation. So what's his point here? Number one, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. You see how that connects to what we read in chapter 2, verse 8? Christ has had everything made subject to him, but we do not see everything subject to him. Faith is the confidence of things not seen. There is a truth that Christians claim that we can't go out into the room and with a test tube or into the world with a camera and record and say, oh, here's the evidence of Christ's rulership over the cosmos, right? It's not quite as easy as that. It's not quite as visible as that. Christianity makes a very bold claim. And it requires, yes, requires, that's in verse 6, we won't even get there today, but in verse 6 it's a requirement. Without faith it is impossible to please him. A requirement of Christian faith is faith. A requirement of Christianity is faith. A capacity to have confidence in something that we admit you cannot see. Now the difference is, and if I may just pause and give my normal rant on faith versus naturalism, because I have to, one of the problems with this passage is that in our modern world, we've equated seeing things with knowing things. Seeing is believing. In our modern world, thanks to a lot to do with the scientific revolution and other things like that, we've decided that the only things you can really know are stuff you can touch and handle and hear and see and look at. Study in a laboratory, that's how you know things, and everything else is guesswork. And so when we hear a statement like this, faith is confidence in unseen things, we're immediately suspicious of faith. We say, so faith isn't really knowing anything anyway, right? Faith isn't knowing anything at all. Faith is not having any evidence at all. Faith is doing something very unreasonable. Faith is a kind of lunacy in that worldview. It's the opposite of knowing things. It's believing in things that you can't possibly prove, if that's the way you're defining knowledge. See the problem? We've equated seeing things with knowing things. But the preacher in this text doesn't think that way. Not for a second. He uses really strong language. If we were all Greek readers, we'd really enjoy verse 1. Instead, you just get to take my word for it. But the language here for assurance and conviction, one of them is a term related to the idea of concrete, of bedrock, a foundation, a material of such strength that you could build something else upon it. The other is more of a courtroom term. It's a term that gets you the conviction. Okay, what is the goal in a courtroom? Think about that a minute. Every juror who has ever lived has been asked by the prosecutor to have faith. What have they been told? Something happened and you didn't see it. We want you to be convinced, to be convicted that it actually happened, and render a verdict to alter another human being's life forever based on what you did not see. Every jury who has ever stood has been asked to have that kind of faith. And then they trot out the evidence. They say, here's someone who did see it. Here's some evidence that makes it seem likely. Here's the supporting evidence. Here's the best we've got. Is this enough? Are you convinced? Is he convicted? See? And that's the kind of language being used in this text. That's what faith is. Faith is the capacity to be certain, to know, but not to see. And it's not a leap in darkness in that sense. It's not a leap into ignorance. It's a different way of knowing than science gives us. But it's absolutely valid. We use it every day. We could not have a justice system without that, without the ability for us to believe in something we didn't personally see. We couldn't tell history without that. Raise your hand if you've met George Washington. Didn't think so. Well, he must not have existed. Nobody saw him. We couldn't even have history if we couldn't believe in things that we've never personally seen. How many of you have seen with your own eyes the circle of the earth, the entire circle of the earth? There's 20-some-odd people in all of human history who have been on a vessel far enough away from the earth that they could see the entire circle. And you're not one of them. Unless there's an astronaut in here I haven't met. Is the earth round or not? You mean you believe in something you cannot possibly see? You mean you look in every direction and everywhere you look it looks pretty flat to you and you believe it's a circle anyway? A sphere? You can have confidence in things you haven't personally seen. Not only that, verse 2 says that's how it's always been. That's how our fathers did things. Our fathers and our forefathers and our fathers behind them, the people of God throughout history, they've always done this. Because has there ever been a time, let's say since Eden, where the world was everything God said it was and could be? There's never been a moment like that. There's always been some distance between what God said must be and what actually was. And what did our fathers do? They believed. They believed in God's reality that they could not see, even above the evidence of their own eyes. He gives another example in verse 3, if you want to look there. By faith we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. He says, let me just give you an example. How do we get here? And it doesn't even matter what your answer is for this question. You can give any ridiculous or absurd answer you want to how we all got here. The preacher's point is you didn't see it. No human being was there. The text claims God was there. The text of Job says the angels rejoiced when God created the world. They shouted for praise and glory. But the rest of us weren't there to see much of it, right? So how, no matter how you read it, or if you throw out Genesis and write your own, no matter what you say about the beginning of all things, you weren't there. And yet most people have an opinion about it. In fact, most people have more than that. Most people have a pretty fair certainty of what they think happened, of how the universe came into existence. For this group of people, they were Christians, by and large, that he's writing to or speaking to. And he says, you have a very clear idea. You believe that God spoke, that words were uttered, and the universe came into existence by that power. Not by things visible. You don't believe that this thing over here made that thing over there, made that thing over here. You don't believe that anything you can see right now made what you can see right now. You believe only the invisible God and His invisible words made the entire visible universe. He says, folks, if you can believe that, then this invisible reality that Jesus says is true, that should be easier to believe, actually. We have that kind of faith all the time. It's how we do anything. It's how we exist. But that's not all. He's going to give us some example of people that they admired that certainly had that kind of faith. And we're going to skip ahead a bit. He gives several examples. He's going to give Abel. He's going to talk about Enoch. He's going to talk about Noah. But we're going to skip to verse 8 and pick up Abraham, who's so often called the father of the faithful. If you want to be faithful, be like Abraham. Well, what is this faithfulness? In what sense did Abraham model this life for us? Read verses 8 through 10. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. So Abraham models faith for us. What is it about Abraham that shows us this kind of faith that we're being asked to have ourselves? His actions, living in the present, lived out the future. He was living out some future reality that God had promised in the present, even though he himself never saw any part of it. What do we mean by that? If you listen to this text carefully, it spells it out piece by piece. God says, go that way. What's out there? He's in a nice little place called Ur of Chaldees. He has family there. He has people there. He knows this place. It's home. God says, go that way. What's that way? Other places. And so Abraham goes. Does he yet see the reality that he's been promised? Does he even know where he's going? Actually, the text answers that question. He goes, and it says in verse 9, the end of verse 8, not knowing where he was going. He doesn't know what it looks like. He doesn't know what it is that he's aiming towards. He doesn't even know how to get there. God says, go that way, and he goes that way. God promises that there is a reality that you have not seen. Something beautiful, a blessing I will bestow on you and your descendants forever if you go that way. And so he goes that way. Didn't Abraham have the same concerns that we have? The difference between the world he saw and the world he was promised was huge. When he started walking around that land, look in verse 9. By faith he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land. Okay? Abraham got there. Abraham got where he was going. And it was never home. For Abraham, what the Jewish people would later call the promised land was a foreign land. Other people live there. The scriptures are emphatic that Abraham never owned any of it. Galatians says it like this: he did not own a piece of ground big enough to put his foot. He walked all over it, but he didn't own a place big enough to put his foot down. When his wife Sarah dies, he has to go barter to find a place to bury her because he doesn't own enough ground to bury his wife. He owns nothing in this land. He owns cattle. He has servants. He has some wealth. But property, he has none. He is in the land of promise and owns none of it. What about great cities? He was promised a nation. I don't know a lot about nations. Nations got big cities though, right? Economy, commerce, great buildings. Where does Abraham live? People in cities were trying to kill him. Abraham lived in a tent. Abraham lived in a tent. He never did live in a city. Only time he ever lived in a city, he got into trouble. Read the story about Egypt. Didn't go well. Had to leave. In the promised land, he lived in a tent, and he never owned a piece of it. Well, that's okay. The promise wasn't just made to Abraham, it was made to Isaac too. How much of that land did Isaac own? Not a piece of it. Well, that's okay. It was made to Isaac's son Jacob. How much did Jacob own? Not a piece of it. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the three fathers of the faithful people. And never in their life did they see the reality that God had promised. God had said, "This land is yours. It is an inheritance. You'll have a nation here." They lived there, but for them it was always a foreign land. It was always property that belonged to somebody else. They were always just travelers there. And that's exactly what it says in verse 10. "For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God." He knew God had promised something better. And he didn't know exactly how it was going to work out. And in his entire life, he never saw it work out. But he lived every day in a tent because he believed in a city. Because he believed what God had promised, he would live every day as a pilgrim and foreigner waiting for that reality to come to pass. And the sermon here says, that's faithfulness. That's what we're being asked to do. It doesn't always look like we think it's supposed to look. We live out in the present, the future that God has promised. And we're not done, because Sarah has an interesting story as well. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on Sarah. In our summer series, Grant Sullivan did a wonderful job on Sarah, and it's online if you want to go back and listen to that. He said better than what I'll ever say. So just go back and listen to his sermon on Sarah. But let me just give you the highlights of it, verses 11 through 12. "By faith, Sarah herself received power to conceive, even when she was past the age, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born descendants as many as the stars of heaven and as many as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore." Now, Sarah's faith is a complicated story because Sarah got there the long way around, right? Sarah had a tough life. Sarah had a difficult life. Sarah had every reason not to believe. Sarah had moments where she certainly did not believe. And God caught her laughing. No, not crying. God caught her laughing at the very suggestion that she would have a child. The name Isaac means laughter, because she laughed at the very possibility that something like that could ever come to pass. But it says she still acted by faith. When the moment came and it all got said and done, she started living out God's promise. Even in Isaac. Now Isaac, I understand, took a long way to get there to Isaac. And Isaac was a promise that was hard to see coming and hard to see fulfilled. But even Isaac is just one child. How many children was Sarah promised? Sands of the sea, stars in the heavens. Isaac's pretty amazing, but I can count. The reality I've been promised is still not what I'm seeing. But she has Isaac and she says, "Well, I laughed before, I won't laugh now, only laughter of joy. Now I believe that God is keeping his word." Did she ever see a nation? Did she and Abraham ever own property or cities or any of that? Did they ever have that big family reunion where the sands of the seashore worth of her grandkids all came around? Did she get to see that? No. But she believed in that reality and she lived that way as she raised Isaac. The future became a reality because Sarah believed and acted before it got there. And that faith made it possible. She models faith for us. So verses 13 through 16 then summarize this big point and drive it home. And this is where we'll end today's lesson, is in verses 13 through 16. What do we mean by faithfulness? He says, "These all died in faith, not having received the things promised. Pause there. If someone promises something to you, you live your entire life and you don't get it, what might be your knee-jerk reaction? I've been lied to. And that's exactly how Christianity in this moment in history felt. They had been promised the kingship of Christ. They had been promised a kingdom. They had been promised glory with the Son of God. And all they've got was suffering and persecution. What have we been told? The name of the Lord will cover the land as the water covers the sea. People will hear the gospel and respond like in the days of Acts. Baptistry will be so busy we'll have to fill it up on Mondays. I mean, we'll be so active and busy, and people will hear and believe, and wonderful things will happen. And do we see that happening every day? Not every day. It doesn't seem to. Sorry, there are days where we get glimpses of good things. There are a lot of other days where we say, "What is going on in the world? Is there going to be such a thing as Christianity in 10 years from now?" And we look and we're tempted to despair. And so the preacher says, "But look at Abraham. Abraham lived his entire life and never received what he was promised, not in fullness. He walked all over the promised land and never owned an inch of it. He had to beg, borrow, and barter for a place to bury his own wife. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city." What's the grand point? These people only ever saw what God promised at a distance. And that was enough. They believed in the reality of what God has promised, and they lived out each and every day with a resolve to keep on marching in that direction. Strangers and foreigners here, but with a promise of what is to come for each one of them. The scriptures then surround us with this cloud of witnesses to faithfulness. You know how lonely you feel when you feel like God has let you down? If you're a Christian and you are suffering in the first century or the 21st century, you feel lonely. It is one of Satan's greatest devices. You are the only one going through this. You are the only one who has been betrayed. God has let you down. Loneliness. How does the apostle, or how does the preacher here see it? He says, "No, we're not alone. First of all, you're not the only people who ever thought, well, it doesn't look like what God promised. Everybody that God has ever promised anything to, at some point noticed, it doesn't quite look that way, does it?" And they had to wait, faithfully wait. And you are surrounded by witnesses. He's mentioned Abraham and Sarah, of Abel, of Enoch and Noah, and he's not done. He's got a whole chapter full of them. Of people who live their lives seeing what God promised at a distance and living every day as if it was already true. And that difference, that capacity to live today because of what God has said about the future, he calls faith. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land to which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. That's easy. That's always available. The life you left behind to become a Christian will always be there, always available. But God has promised something better, and it's worth waiting for. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. That's the statement in that whole paragraph that shocks me the most. God is the infinitely holy, infinitely good, perfectly wise, perfectly powerful, creator of the universe. I am a man guilty of sin. I am a speck in the cosmos. And this preacher in this sermon says, If you will believe in what God has promised and live today in obedience waiting for that promise, God is not ashamed to be called the God of Benjamin Williams. God is not ashamed to be called their God and they His people. That's what He's expecting out of us. Great acts and feats of obedience, that'd be wonderful. Notice He doesn't really describe a lot of that. Amazing things happen in the life of Abraham. He's going to go to Moses next. Amazing things happen in the life of Moses. But that's not the thing the writer points out as being the thing that God's not ashamed of. What God is so happy with in people's life is their willingness to wait, to believe, and to live, living out the life God has promised will come. Living like heaven today. Though the world certainly doesn't look like it. That's the call of Christianity. It's why we end sermons by saying, believe the gospel and obey it. Because we're asking for and we're looking for that faith, that confession of what has not yet been seen, but what must change the life we live today. They remind us that we live today anticipating God's tomorrow. And those faithful witnesses remind us that we live in a world not in subjection to Him, but we anticipate a world that is entirely subject to Him. And I'm going to start with me. If you've not obeyed the gospel of Christ, if you have not made yourself utterly subject to Him, then as we stand and sing, won't you come at this time?